Lead UX, the User Experience Leadership Circle, hosted by Dr. Thomas Führinger-Kühlt. Warm welcome to Lead UX, the UX Leadership Circle, your compass for navigating the ever-evolving landscape of UX leadership and UX maturity in organizations. My guest today is UX design strategist Jonathan Arnowitz. Welcome to the show, Jonathan. Great to have you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So could you first of all introduce yourself to our listeners and describe your current role a bit?
Yeah, certainly. My name is Jonathan Arnowitz. I have worked in design for 25-30 plus years, and I've worked for a large multitude of companies on both sides of the water. I've worked for SAP, Google, IBM. I've worked for small startups. I've worked for agencies, and I've designed in many different domains, everything from medical, technical. I've even designed a mobile phone. And many other different domains. I've specialized in the last 5 years in design management, and in the last 10 years, kind of my bread and butter has been the visualization of large data sets and the development and the design of narrative dashboards.
Mm-hmm.
And my current role, I am a principal consultant for Keen Design, where I help coach design and mentor design on projects as well as within the company. And I do some design myself too, because I still like to roll up my sleeves.
Great. Yeah, great to hear. So you're really super experienced in the field, and it's awesome to pick your brain a bit and learn from your strategies. So,
take away.
What motivates you to work in the, what motivated you actually in the beginning to enter the UX field, and why do you, or what do you get up for in the morning?
Yeah, what originally motivated me? Well, that's kind of a long story, but to give you maybe the shortened version, I found the whole idea of the accessibility of technology very, very interesting to me. It was also a time 30 plus years ago, there was no HCI education as we know it now. It was mostly people who were in the cognitive psychology or experimental psychologist field and other more engineering design, engineering-driven professions. So what I thought was really fascinating was how I could apply my design skills, because I actually have a theater background where I was doing set design and playwriting and directing, how I could apply those design skills to actually make technology more user-friendly. And I saw immediately the value of design methods in what was then just, you know, kind of the experimental psychological approach to how you try to understand users' mental models and fit them to your conceptual model, your UI, user interface, and try to make that work. That was a fascinating fascinating challenge. But then I'd like to add to the challenge is how do you also make that conceptual model something that's actually desirable and something that's compelling? And to this end, that's always been for me a major motivation is the making the technology really work for people through the use of design and user experience. And the other thing I really have a passion for is just the magic of the design process and a fascination with it. So I've developed a passion for both cognitive psychology as well as for design. Cognitive psychology, I was pretty much self-taught. I read a lot of, you know, the classic books like Card, Newell, and Moran, and the HCI handbook, and all those great things. But then also trying to marry those approaches with Donald Schoen, Henry Fowler, and all these the great designers, and, you know, Dieter Rams, and how you could merge these into making great digital products, not just physical ones.
Yeah, great to hear. So I think motivation-wise, we have a lot in common. So I also have a background in psychology and moved into engineering. And then, yeah, also my motivation is, as well as you described it, to make products and digital products and physical products desirable.
And it's often misunderstood, but psychology is the root of design. I mean, even design itself is a psychological field. I mean, think of Gestalt psychology, psychology of everyday things, things to download. I mean, psychology is rooted in both design and UX in very different ways, but still.
Yeah. And you also mentioned that you are interested in understanding and shaping the design process and strategy itself. So nowadays, we talk about user experience design as a profession, but for you, does it mean that design and UX follow the same processes?
No, they don't. As I kind of alluded to in my description of what's fascinated me about design, I think one of the things that kind of put people on the wrong footing is early on we had the idea of user-centered design. And because it had the word design in it, we thought that this was design, whereas I think it was, in practice, the way it was practiced, user-centered design was actually more of an engineering exercise. And you certainly saw that when design started getting introduced into technology, and UX and design were really bumping up against each other, and there was a lot of friction. The core of the difference is, as I mentioned, with user experience, it's really finding the right research methods for understanding the user's mental model. And these days, you have to understand that broadly as the stakeholders' mental models, not just the mental model of the user, but the customer, the person who has to buy it, the person who has to sell it, the person who has to build it. You really have to find a way to communicate in their mental models using a conceptual model, aka a design. And that's where design fits in, where there is then a parallel. They're interconnected, but they're not the same. Because with design is a more abstract and I'd say more timeless process, where you take a existing situation and turning it into a desirable one. And I can't claim I'm now quoting Herbert Simon and Clement Mach. Herbert Simon originally said turning an existing situation into a preferable one, and Clement Mach just changed the word preferable to desirable, which I think was a good correction. And I think that's also, so there's a two, there is also then a tension, because people who are overly knowledgeable about UX and not so much in design tend to neglect design, and vice versa. People who don't understand UX and just go for design, just use the design process, and both will not get you a good result unless you work together, either as two separate individuals or a individual who's lacking in design, beefs up their design skills, or is a designer who needs to beef up their UX skills.
Yeah, so in my daily practice, I often experience also conflicting goals between the different disciplines. Also, when engineers then come into play, you have the designers, yeah, you have the concept developers, you have the engineers who actually build the product, being it software or any hardware-related products. So from your experience, how do you prevent conflicting goals between those different teams and silos, if there are silos at all?
Well, I think that touches the problem. If there's silos, the game is almost pretty much lost. You can do a lot to influence an outcome, but if there are silos, you can't get around the fact that the developers are the last ones with their hands in the code. And when it's an engineering-driven company, engineers are not graded on their quality of the UI work, but rather the quality of their functions. So whether it passes QA, not whether it passes a usability test. So they will sacrifice the UI. And even when UX often has a seat at the table at sprint reviews or release reviews, their bugs, as they're often called, their UI bugs, are often given a very low priority, and no engineer wants to rebuild the same design over again. They'd much rather do new things, and not only that, they're also rewarded to do that. So when you're into a silo situation, it's going to be a losing battle. The way to knock down the silos, even if they are silos, you can psychologically knock them down by engaging people as partners, where you approach people, product management, developers, researchers, designers, marketers, all the people, all the different stakeholders. If you approach them as co-owners and as partners that you then treat with mutual respect, that gets you a much better result. That is, and that is a more of an informal organization. So there could be silos in the organization, but if you can find a way to actually reach out to people, and instead of treating you as a designer, have them treat you as a human being, and you treat them as a human being, my experience has always been that people in general are decent enough folks that they like to work together if that's the way you approach them. Too often, people try to say, like, an engineer will say, like, oh, you're just a designer. How do you come up with, you know, why do you get to decide what it looks like? I think it should look like X, Y, or Z. If you don't have that much of respect, you're showing that either the person's, you know, doesn't care about design, which actually, if you listen to the person's comedy, does. He says, well, I think I can know. But if you're treated with mutual respect, so instead of throwing a design overboard, you explain to them what's in the design and you allow them to give you feedback because they have valuable feedback to give, you get a much better result that way.
Yeah, so the negotiation skills and communication skills are basic to become or to act as a good UX leader. So, and is there anything beyond Absolutely. Those core soft skills which you would define as necessary for UX leaders?
I would say in my profession, I have done maybe 30% design and 70% diplomacy. And a lot of that is based on, you know, knowing interpersonal skills, knowing what motivates people. And I think to be really effective is you don't have to worry about having to be right. Let other people be right. Let other people think that your idea is their idea. If it gets implemented, that's what you want. The end result is that you keep your eye on the prize. So when you work with people, you try to be you try to discourage people from, you know, letting their egos, even, you know, your own ego or even the ego of others, for example, in a typical design review, I tell people never start a comment or critique of a design with the words "I like" or "I don't like," because there's nothing you can do with that information. It's not material. It's an egotistical statement whether you like or dislike something. And who says you're the user? And who's to say that even if you were that you're right? It's much better to lean forward with your intelligence. For example, this is not the right, I think this is the wrong color because the contrast isn't appropriate enough. Lead with your intelligence and you try to bring things to an objective level. And if you do that with your design colleagues and also your partners, your stakeholder partners as well, those are the things that moving things to an objective level, that's how you get to a great design.
Yeah. So it sounds like stakeholder management is most important thing to get products right and desirable.
But of a certain kind. Like I said, bringing things to an objective level. I have been in a lot of meetings, like where, for example, if a CEO, you know, has like what I would call the Steve Jobs syndrome and thinks that they could just start saying, oh, make this green or make this blue, which, by the way, Steve Jobs never did. But I mean, that's the myth. You learn to actually, for each stakeholder, meet them on their level to the extent that, you know, that you need to. In this example, this may sound counterintuitive, but whenever a CEO says to do something like that, I say, oh yeah, sure, okay, we'll do that. And then not do it.
Yeah.
Because you don't have to worry about it because the CEO is a busy person. He or she's got many things to do. And if you turn around and you show them a coherent design, they've forgotten all about whatever it is they said, if they haven't actually already forgotten about it at the moment the meeting ended. So you got to take each stakeholder's input in the way that you should intend it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. So it's actually, not user-centered design in a sense that you take the stakeholder as a user, definitely not, but give the stakeholder or sell them what they want, but give them what they need kind of approach.
Yeah, it's right. That's very true, because like it or not, a lot of people are going to make judgments on your design. Are not going to be the user. It's got to go through a lot of gates before the user ever sees it. And it's not always the case that whatever the user wants is going to result in a successful product. Mm-hmm. Sometimes showing a design that the user looks at and goes, "What is that actually?" But it's not an important problem. But it's the person who really goes, "Wow," is the person who's going to buy it, because they're going to like, "Oh my God, that's great! I want that. I'll buy that immediately." And then you try as much as possible to kind of make that kind of like a demoware product, and then give the user what they really need. But that's not always possible. Sometimes it's a trade-off. Everything are trade-offs. There's no such thing as a perfect interface.
Mm-hmm. No.
And it's not like, it's not like there's like this perfect interface that's good for all the users anyway. You know, there's always going to be, you know, it's the 80% rule that when you get 80% of the functionality right, the other 20% doesn't really matter, because one man's bug is another man's feature, you know?
Yeah, very true. Yeah, this reminds me of, I don't know if it was a quote by Alan Cooper or so. So make frequently used tasks easy to use and other tasks just possible to use, or something like that. Yeah.
Well, they should be, all right. Well, there should be a sense of priority and layering in your interface. It's the agreement for the user. The way I would like to rephrase the Alan's quote is: the agreement is easy things should be easy, hard things should be proportionally harder, no more and no less.
Yeah. All right. Now coming back to the more strategic level of UX design in organizations. How important do you think is a certain maturity level or a high maturity level in organizations to develop innovative products?
Yeah, that's a good question. A lot of people would interpret that question to mean UX maturity, but of course, as we've earlier discussed, there's actually two levels of there's two dimensions of maturity. One is UX maturity, and the other is their design maturity. Now, the UX maturity is to what level is an organization aware of user experience? So to what extent are they appreciative and knowledgeable in user research, the need for user research, the need for UX design methods like conceptual designs and task analysis, journey mapping, etc., which is very good to have. But I think it's a good to have, because the trade-off there is, if instead of a UX maturity, you have a design maturity, you're going to get a lot farther. Because if with a design maturity, someone who is a developer isn't going to understand everything about UX, nor should he. He's a developer, and a UX person shouldn't really know about pointers and scripting and all these developed things, because your concentration actually should be in your profession. What you do with a design maturity is you trust one another to practice what you've done and to work together, and to know that when different professions work together, when different disciplines work together to a common goal in a design savvy way, you get a good result. Then the UX maturity is less important. I'm not saying that it's irrelevant, and I'm not saying one's better than the other. The gold standard is they have both, right? But it's also unrealistic to expect them to have both. I think sometimes UX leaders can be a little arrogant to think like, oh, all the companies should worry about UX. It's like, well, and actually, no, they shouldn't. Let UX handle UX. Let developer handle development. Let marketing handle marketing. Know your stuff, but know how to work together. And I think that's where design really helps to break down barriers.
Okay,
and
so
I think, yeah.
Sorry, didn't want to interrupt, but just wanted to double check if I understood correctly. So design maturity for you is everybody is super skilled in his or her profession and provides this to the success of the overall product. And they trust each other and respect each other.
Yeah, and you get engaged in conversations where, like, for example, you talk to a product manager and you're talking about there's a problem in the product or service. And you say, well, one thing we can do is this, we could do participatory design. And you come up with this idea and you explain it to them and they have an interaction. Oh, that's interesting. How would that work? And there's a curiosity. Just like if I talk to a developer who's having trouble developing something that I've designed, they could say, well, you know, this is going to, the data will take so long to come to the main screen that the user will be waiting forever for the screen to refresh. So that would allow us to then have a give and take, telling me enough that I can then respond to and come up with a better design. And that kind of sharing is far more valuable than really having that developer, he or she know whether there is participatory design or whether, you know, Wizard of Oz prototyping is the best prototyping process for this or that. That's our profession, is to know what's the right tool at the right time. You know.
And now when companies start to realize that they would benefit from user-centered design practices, they often start to hire one person, poor guy, UX, UI designer or something like that. And then the team evolves step by step. So what do you think, or what would you recommend to somebody starting a UX team? What is important to build a strong UX team? And if there's already a smaller team, how would you strengthen also the team, either by adding additional roles and which are important from your point of view, or by other means to empower them?
Yeah. It's funny. So many times I've seen the temptation for companies, especially startups, that are newly discovering design. They want to start. Let's start slowly. So they'll do the absolute wrong thing and hire someone junior and ask them to do everything. And they find out they can't. So you mean you can't? So sometimes they end up hiring the wrong people because most of the time they know. Oh yeah, the UI, that's the visual. So visual design. But most of the work that's done in user experience design is invisible. It's the interaction. You can't see that. So what they should do is the opposite. They should hire someone who has a broad experience of UX, who can be like a one-man band. And someone who's got enough experience in UX and has had touch points with graphic designers and researchers, that's probably the best person to start. What we would call in our field a generalist, and then as needs are become more and more apparent and more specialized, to then slowly add, because it's not like you can instantly suddenly make this a UX savvy company overnight. That takes time, so it's best to get as mature a person in there to help foster the right organization. So that they're initially getting the biggest bang for their buck. So they're getting a generalist who can do a little bit of everything and will probably specialize in one particular thing. And that will kind of see them through to the point where they're ready actually to then become more UX mature and then also more design mature.
And you mentioned this process takes time. So to your experience, if a company really starts from scratch building a UX team or raise the design maturity, how long would it take until they reach the next level or a certain step?
Yeah. Well, as a designer, I'm obliged to answer that as it depends. And it depends on how design friendly the people are themselves. I have had there was a CEO for a startup. Her background was in mathematics and then engineering, but she got design. She just got it. Didn't have to. I never had to explain anything about the design process. She intuitively kind of understood and got it. So it really depends how prepared the organization is to understand and deploy design processes as well as UX methods.
Yeah, you mentioned here a CEO as an example, and I also think it's really crucial also educate the decision makers, high level decision makers, CEO level, VP level, if they are coming from other disciplines, yeah, to understand the design and UX process. I think that's really crucial. Otherwise, bottom up, it's really tough to increase maturity, I think.
Yeah, and I have to say, I think I was always big on having brown bags, educational, this is, in case you want to know what UX is, this is what it really is. I think now, looking back on when I did those, I still do them from time to time because they are helpful, but they're not as effective as leading by example. Yeah. When they actually see, I mean, it's one thing to tell someone, well, I know all this stuff. That's why I can make these decisions about where pixels go. But it's another thing that in the project, you actually explain to them why a certain design it would work for a user. And then and for them to understand it, that's really where they get to learn the value of UX. These ground bags and everything, they're sometimes good. They're kind of one-offs. People forget more than really stick to them. What really sticks to them is when you as a designer or UX designer lead by example. That's where it sticks, is in the project, in the course of the project. And that's why I also say, like, when you start out small, you start to gain credibility. And if you start, as you gain credibility, that's kind of where people become more open to you as a partner in the development process.
Yeah, I agree. But as you mentioned before, a lot of UX work is beneath the surface. I think those lunch and learn or brown bag events are just too important to show and tell what you actually do during the design process, I think. So not only educating high-level management, but also educating your peers. Yep. On working level.
And the ones that are always, to me, the most valuable ones are the ones that use a lot of humor, so you can really draw someone in. And so you try to draw on things that they can relate to. So I wouldn't go into different forms of user research and what you could learn from that. Instead, try to just, play on their short-term memory, their limitations of their own short-term memory, and you can kind of that they get to now they get to enjoy. This really is a problem I'd never noticed before. But then they also get like, okay, this kind of sticks with me, as when they can actually experience firsthand the problems of poor design. Yeah, that was, like the door. It's like, everyone has trouble with the design of doors, and everyone's pushed, but doors that should be pulled. And despite the fact that there's a sign, and it's interesting to just tell them, and very eye opening for them to realize that there's no way that solution could ever work. You're going to decide whether to push or pull the door long before you've read it. So mathematically speaking, with the way your brain works, that will never work. And that's very important for someone to realize that nobody reads your interface. Developers always think like, oh, let's put blocks of text about how to use it, and then we're done with our responsibility to the user. But the user doesn't read anything. They scan. They look for structure. And so looking at those things, those are kind of like these okay, I can get that. They're getting those things that can stick in their mind. Those things are very valuable.
Yeah, yeah.
But going into teaching them trying to turn them into a designer or design techniques or research techniques, I think that's always been a waste of time.
Mm. Coming back to the example you mentioned regarding explanations to certain features or so, I think there is a joke that UX actually is like a joke. If it needs an explanation, it's not good.
Yeah. Very good.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to use that one.
You're welcome. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah,
And it's not unlike, you know, the best design is the invisible, is the design you don't see, right?
Yeah, right. So coming back to the team structure or ramping up teams. So, I mean, it's not only important to get the right people on board, but also to keep the right people in the company, especially nowadays, at least in Europe. Yeah. There's a lack of talent simply. So what would you recommend to companies? How can they keep their talents in-house?
Well, I think the best way to do that is to take the design profession seriously and show that you do that by initiating something that I've done almost everywhere where I've been a design manager. And that's something I call design studio time. That's where you set aside a half a day or a full day, depending on the needs of the organization, where designers just work together and they reflect on their designs and improve their designs in their own design environment using their own design skills. And there's activities that are based on those, on you know, the way the designers work. It's also this is a specific example of the bigger point, which is. Show that you are serious about design by not just talking about design, but walking with the designer and making sure that you actually take design seriously. Give them the tools that they need. Give them the room to answer their profession. I think it is horrible to see companies telling a designer, we're going to start development in 2 weeks. Can we have your design, you know, in 2 weeks? Yeah. Mm. First of all, as if you needed a full design when development starts, which is never the case because the development's not going to develop the entire thing all in 2 weeks. Secondly, it shows so little respect and so little care for creativity, because if someone's going to be sloshing out a design, that's not going to be a design that they're going to feel any sense of pride or any sense of feeling like I'm being respected, and that's going to create an unhappy employee, and they're going to go somewhere else.
Yep.
So if you want them not to go somewhere else, show them that you actually take their profession, not them, but them and their profession seriously, and that you're willing to grow them as a designer, but also give them time to practice their design.
From your experience, if we look at younger people entering the job market, do you think there are even more such kind of expectations from Gen Z employees?
It's funny. I definitely think so. There's a strange kind of history with UX where it's led to a strange dynamic in the past. And I'm saying like 10, 20 years ago, UX people tended to be these failed developers. The developer couldn't develop well. What are they doing? Well, they'll have them do the UI. And they weren't very good at it, but it wasn't that important because of the way computers were approached in those days. There was very little, until fairly recently, until, you know, really Steve Jobs' second turn at Apple, did people really start to care about actually the user experience. And then they start hiring designers. And those designers, they have like, okay, there's a UX designer that does UX pretty well. There's a designer who does design pretty well, but not UX. So then you get now Gen Z, you get people who have more what I would consider a full stack design education and experience and expectations. And you get this effect where junior people know more about user experience than the senior people do. And I have had, you know, people, you know, because I was working for this storied company, and When I give examples, I say you get the name or the story. So you're getting the story, so you don't get the name. And I would get people, and I was in this small group of incubator designs for this company. And I would have junior designers always showing up at my doorsteps, like, we work for you, because they were working with people who were, well, blatantly incompetent, who couldn't really teach them anything because they had nothing to teach. It was the opposite. They knew more about design than they did. And because of that, a lot of these UX managers felt more threatened by that and wanted to just like, well, I don't know about that. And they would trivialize what that person's work is. And which would lead to some people thinking, oh, I guess design's not that important. And they would then, okay, then they'd swallow that. But the smart people would stand up and say, no, this is BS, and then follow, then I'm going to go somewhere else. And I think that it's the younger designers are the ones that are actually kind of shaking the tree, because their competence level tends to be higher than the average senior person.
I think that's also because we have nowadays a lot more high-value educational programs. Often they can even code, at least to a certain level. So it's really like the generalist you mentioned before. This is what they get in their education. And yeah, that's also what I experienced. They know a lot, but still they expect mentoring. So they want to know how they can develop. So I think career paths, providing career paths is also an important topic.
Oh, absolutely. When we're talking about letting designers be designers, that has to include a career ladder where UX can climb as high as developers. There was a long time, I remember, where I worked for a very famous company that has a unwarranted, well, good reputation on design, where there were no design directors. They could go up to a senior manager, no further. That was it. And that's now become, thankfully, a thing that's getting more and more rare, where now all of a sudden there's an equal career ladder for a designer. But it's got to be also a career ladder that's done by someone who knows what design really is, so that it makes saying that, you know, I will start doing this. Very often you'll see design management positions where there's no design going on. And hence the word UX manager is not, in my mind, a design manager, because they wouldn't know the first thing about design. They tend to be more traffic cops or personnel or people management, but not design management. Mm. Because there's kind of like this, it's not like the Peter principle. It's the ladder's made to be a Peter principle, that someone floats to the highest level of their incompetence. If instead of going up to changing over from being an individual contributor to a manager, you realize, no, design is this backbone that follows you throughout your career, and you graduate from being an individual contributor to a conceptual designer, to a project designer, to a design manager, that's something that enriches that's a design career ladder, not just a career ladder that, oh, you can do this too. Now you don't get to design anymore because you're a manager. That's the bad news. Good news is we'll pay you more money. You know, it's, you know, that's not a good career ladder for a designer.
Yeah. So finally, what would you recommend to junior managers who want to grow their career ladder?
Yeah, they got to. It's funny. You have to find out. You have to be sensitive to who your management is. No senior manager, especially someone who's been in the profession 10 plus years, who thinks they know it all, is eager to hear that they don't know it all. So you have to kind of tread carefully around some of those people, and you got to kind of test out, you know, who are the right people to talk to. That's kind of why junior designers wound up with me and my incubator team. Because they were just sounding out, oh, do you know what you're talking about? You don't know what you're talking about. Okay, let me go somewhere. So try to feel out two things. Try to feel out, you know, where people who hear you can understand you, but then also where people are willing to understand you. So So people who say like, oh, this is, I don't know what this person's talking about, but it's making sense to me. This is interesting. So be open to going around the system, because maybe the system's not so designed for the way you want to go forward. And again, pull out that, that embassy card, become a very good ambassador, be diplomat first, and learn your way to how to get up to the ladder when you don't have a supportive UX environment. If you're lucky, some companies don't. They you have. I mean, I don't want to paint a dire picture like we're all incompetent imbeciles. There are some. They are design aware companies, and those are a delight to work for. And if you're not in a design friendly company, and you think you're going to be just just slaving away fruitlessly, then change companies. Go where you don't waste your talents on people who don't understand what you're what you bring to the table. That serves nobody's purpose. Just one last comment about that, because then you're starting to show, if you start slaving away at stuff that's not really that good, you're not going to have a very impressive portfolio. You're not going to have a very impressive work history. So I'd say really find out a place where you can spread your wings, and as a junior manager, because your question was about, let other people spread their wings. Last thing a junior manager should, or any manager should do, is hold other people down.
Great advice and great final words, I would say, for this podcast at least. Thank you very much for your time. It was great talking to you.
I
And
enjoyed it. Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. This was nice. I
yeah,
really enjoyed this.
likewise, me too. And yeah, thanks. And maybe talk to you soon at any other opportunity. Thank you.
I'd love to do that. Yeah.
All right.
Thanks.
Thanks. Bye.
Okay. Goodbye.
Thank you.